This is Iconic with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick.
Welcome to Iconic, the podcast where we talk about all things 13th Age. You're listening to episode one. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick and Mark.
Hello.
Hey.
Always so far for episode zero and one. So what are we covering this week? We're going to be talking about icons. What are they? What's the idea behind icons? Why are they such an integral part to 13th Age? How you can use them at your table? And for our monster look this week, we're going to be looking at the White Dragon, one of the monsters who has a very unique tie to the icons.
It also makes up a really cool logo.
It does make a really great logo.
That iconic look.
All right, Jamie, well, why don't you go ahead and start and tell us what are icons?
All right, well, if you've got your book, you can follow along. Page 13 of the 13th Age Core Rulebook. Icons are the powerful NPCs, the movers and shakers of the world. If you are coming from a non-13th Age background but know anything about role-playing games, they are the Elminsters. They are the Dritzdwardens. These are the people who have moved beyond just the realm of mortals. To use a term that is familiar to all of the hosts, because we read the Malazan books of the Fallen, these are kind of like the ascendants of the world. Would you guys agree with that?
Cotillion.
Yeah, that's right. He would make
the not quite gods.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, demi or pseudo gods, not quite. Because if you read some of the descriptions, like the Crusader, the armored fist of the dark gods. So there are gods, but these are kind of like one step below, more of their mortal
emissaries and chosen.
Yeah, on this plane.
So for me, coming from the GM side, the icons are something that I really like. They're a way to tie the background pieces that are very important to you very viscerally into your players and game. Each player has a number of relationship dice, which we'll look at in the one unique thing. But for right now, you just need to know that every player has some direct ties with these icons, and they will interact with the story each session.
Well, and one of the nice things about the use of icons as a player is it gives you, the players, a little bit of a motivation why they're doing what they're doing, and potentially even a little bit of a tie into some of the other players. One of the one-shots that I ended up playing, there was another character and I who had a very similar icon, or our two icons had a connection with each other. And so we ended up being able to play off of each other a little bit in the storytelling, and it made for a much more enjoyable game. It allowed us to just kind of jump right in and get involved.
Excellent. Well, the icons that the writers of 13th Age have presented us with run the gamut, but they are also very familiar. I think anybody who has read fantasy or played in a fantasy RPG can see kind of these iconic ideas that are threaded through most stories. So I was just going to take us through the icons. We can jump around, talk about each one, kind of what we think. The first one's the Archmage. He's kind of the big magical powerhouse in the Empire, or in the Dragon Empire, which is the setting for 13th Age. He's kind of the caretaker, the guy who makes sure everything stays up and running and chaos gets pushed to the outer edges of the Empire.
Well, Mark, since you already mentioned the Crusader, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the Crusader, as you read the description, is the armored fist of the dark gods. He's the one that does the dirty work. Stay out of his way, and everything's fine.
That's right. He has an intense desire to kill demons, which kind of makes him sound like a good icon, but as we dig into him, he's not really. I personally like the Diabolist. I'm a fan of any kind of crazy person with power who deals with forces that no one else would. She summons demons, but everybody thinks that there might be a different side to her because she has a plan, and sometimes she's helpful, sometimes she's not. So,
we also have the Dwarf King. He's the Lord of the Forge, which is the dwarves' new homeland beneath the mountains. His whole land is where we get the Forgeborn. He's kind of inspired to kind of rebuild the Dwarven Empire, so you can use him either as a, you know, to try to help him along in that. He probably would do what he could to further his own kingdom in that way.
Okay.
Next, we have the Elf Queen, your atypical pointy-eared dandelion eater.
That's right.
She brings all the elves together and supposedly is as powerful as the Archmage.
The Emperor takes the place of any god king that you might have in your world. rules the greatest human empire in the land, kind of is the iconic law figure, pardon the pun, as in like law versus chaos. He's the focal point of civilization.
We also have the Great Gold Worm. He's the world's protector and the inspiration for holy orders of paladins and independent heroes. He's kind of a mixed bag. Physically, he's sealing the gap between the abyss from, you know, interacting and erupting into the world. But his spiritually speaking, he's an inspiration to his followers and tries to get them to combat the evils that are taking over.
We have the High Druid, champion of the wild, magical leader of spirits, nature, elements, and adhering to that nice neutral, using the law, chaos neutral, could help the Empire or destroy it.
Yeah, very much a first edition kind of feel to that icon. The Lich King for all of your undead needs apparently used to be the equivalent of the Emperor until the elves somehow created the Orc Lord. I was doing some research earlier today. So they made the Orc Lord to kill the Wizard King, which he did, you know, huzzah. And then, like most elven clans, it backfired on them, and he came back as the Undead King, or the Lich King, and that has not worked out very well for them.
At least he's not the Demi-Lich King.
That's right. And he would just be a head floating around.
Well, and then the Orc Lord fell off the map and just kind of disappeared. And then many thousands and thousands of years later, he reemerged, and he's walking the land again, pulling the various orcs and orc races to himself to plunder and pillage the continents.
Then we have the Priestess. Here's all gods of light. Speaks for those who please her. Really the oracle, mystic part of it. Created the cathedral, which when you explore the world.
Yeah. Pretty big place.
Yeah. And entire wings for faith, so she's kind of that multi-faith icon.
Yeah. Prince of Shadows, another one of my favorites. Seems like I might have just started this round robin in my favor. He is your coyote. He is your trickster god. He is the wild card that no one really knows what he's doing or why. Anytime you want to pull an Ocean's 11 in your game, it is probably tied in with the Prince of Shadows.
And then at the founding of the age, there were a number of dragons who pooled their powers together to kind of create everything. And the three were among those first dragons, comprised of the red, the blue, and the black. They each have their own little alignment and personality to them, but collectively they work together to join forces and keep the powers of evil at bay. They're a little bit different from the Great Gold Worm in that they do work together, whereas the Gold Worm works alone.
The Gold Worm stands alone.
The Gold Worm stands alone.
That's right. So when you're getting into the icons, what we find in the profiles, that was just kind of an overview, but each icon has a profile. Gives you a little quote, the location where you can find them on the map, common knowledge, adventures, and the icons, kind of how party members would tie back to this icon. Most importantly, his allies, his or her allies, and their enemies. So you can, as Nick said, have players playing off these relationships that they have with the icons. Their history and their one true danger.
And just to kind of jump in with the playing off, it's not always in companionship, it's sometimes antagonistic, which adds to the tension of the group. Because, you know, you're not really, you know, speaking from a GM standpoint now, it's more fun when the players are kind of looking at each other like, huh, can I trust him?
Oh, yeah. We have that happen many a times on our the game that I have with Nick. We have players who are constantly looking for the advantage to backstab other players. And as the GM, I just sit behind my screen and kind of cackle with glee. One thing that I do want to point out about the icons, and we're going to be going into each icon in depth over future episodes, but each icon has a true danger. And the true danger is basically, here's what the status quo with this icon is, and it will be, everything will be okay unless X happens. So basically, you're getting 13 campaign ideas, because if an icon goes wrong, it is a world-shattering event. We will be talking about in future episodes how to adapt icons from different settings, create your own. This is one of the things that I'm doing for all of my games. And I have to tell you, following this template that they have in the book, making icons is super easy. The thing to remember, or at least in my opinion, the thing to remember is that these are not people that the PCs are necessarily ever going to interact with. That was always my problem with Elminster and Forgotten Realms. Elminster's running around at like 90th level. What does the Forgotten Realms need me for? And any time a DM used him in a game, it was basically to show off how cool Elminster was. This lets you have those iconic personalities without having them running ramshod over your world.
So if the players are never going to actually interact with them in the game, how do they interact with them as an icon?
Well, that's a good question. We're going to be looking at that in our next segment about relationship dice.
One unique thing.
Okay, so we're in One Unique Thing. This is where we take a in-depth look at one rule or shiny bit of the 13th Age system. And right now we're looking at relationship dice. Nick, why don't you tell us what relationship dice are?
Well, relationship dice is a mechanism used by the GMs and players. Usually each of the players at the beginning of the session roll a d6, or a d6 per relationship point that they have. So if they start out with two relationship points, they'd roll two d6 and so on and so forth. And for every five or six that they roll, they are going to have, or the GM has the ability to provide an encounter with that that icon in some way, shape, or form throughout the session. If they roll a six, then it's going to be a very positive interaction with that icon. If they roll a five, it will still be a positive interaction, but there will also be a balancing, somewhat negative interaction as well.
And Nick kind of touched on this. So with the relationship dice tie a player directly back to the icon that they choose. You have positive, conflicted, or negative relationships. And then you have, you know, the icons are broken up into heroic, ambiguous, and villainous icons. You can't see me doing the air quotes. Yeah, I'm doing the air quotes. Heroic icons, ambiguous icons, and villainous icons. So, Mark, what are our heroic icons?
Heroic icons, usually the Archmage, the Emperor, Great Gold Worm, or the Priestess, possibly the Dwarf King or the Elf Queen, depending how they work.
Ambiguous icons are usually the Crusader, the Dwarf King, the Elf Queen, the High Druid, the Prince of Shadows, and possibly the Emperor and the Three.
And for the villainous icons, we usually have the Diabolist, the Lich King, the Orc Lord, the Three, and possibly, depending on the situation, the Crusader and the Prince of Shadows.
That's one thing that I really like. They're not, if you listen to their terminology, we have usually and possibly. They're not locking icons into, oh, well, I'm sorry, you have to use the Dwarf King as an ambiguous icon. No, the Dwarf Kings could be the noble leader of the dwarves. So what has your experience been with relationship dice in the game, Nick?
Well, a couple of instances that come to mind is for one of the playtests, we came across this this boat underground. We had no idea how it got there or anything like that, and there was a couple of undead sailors on the deck playing dice for gold. And so one of the players in our game had, you know, jumped on board, started interacting with them, started gambling with them a little bit, and it came to find out that the boat was owned by or sent by one of his icons. And because he had rolled a positive or a six at the beginning of that session, it was sent there to help him out in some way. And while we never actually got around to, or we ended up getting out of the cave in a different way, but one of the thoughts we had in the moment was that once we got our gold or the treasure, whatever it was we were looking for in that cave, we could hightail it back to the boat and somehow magically be whisked away out of the cave and wherever we needed to go. So that's an example of a entirely positive interaction with an icon.
Mark, you've played in a couple of one-shots. What are your thoughts on icons and relationship dice from player or GM side?
From the GM side, it definitely gets the players involved, gets them thinking about, and this is probably very important when they're creating a character, what icon they want to be associated or opposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helps when you get the player involvement as far as moving the story over instead of going, okay, JM, your character walks into the cave and fights an owlbear. It's fun for 5 minutes, but there's no lasting campaign buy-in.
Right.
So this helps, and it gives you ways to help move the story along, I think. Maybe when they're stuck, that six you rolled at the beginning of the session,
Oh, yeah.
Hey, here's that friendly guy in the tavern that comes up that you have no idea who he is, and he helps you with something, and helps you move along. Because we've all been there as GMs where you think you've planned so well and laid it out, and the party is just not buying it. They have no idea what you're talking about. You're like, how can I move this along?
Yeah, how did I convince them that X was actually Y when all of the clues I've planned out are obviously the term that we use for that at my gaming table is the villain is made of living sound. There was a game we were running, and a buddy of mine was GMing, and he laid out all of these clues, and somehow the players came up with not that the big bad guy had gone to a different part of town, but that he was actually made of living sound. And yeah, Corey just didn't recover from that that session. So,
well, GM, why don't you give us an example of like if someone rolled a five? What would be like a balancing interaction with an icon?
So one of the things I like about the icons is that you can have a positive, a negative, or a conflicted relationship with the icon. So a lot of it depends on that. If you have a conflicted relationship with a good icon, you may owe them something. So one of the examples that was either in the book or on somewhere that I read is if you have a conflicted relationship with the Elf Queen, then maybe you're doing, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the session stops and GM needs to get the session going again, and somebody shows up and says, all right, she's calling in part of her debt. Here's the clue, or here's the MacGuffin, or here's something to sweeten the pot, but because of your complication, you have to go this way. I've also used in my games somebody showing up. I had a player who had a negative relationship with a negative icon. So they hated somebody everyone else hated, and they rolled a five. And so they were going through the city, and an ally or an enemy of this negative icon showed up and said, hey, you're going to try and foil this person, this icon's plots? Here's this awesome magic item. Player never blinked twice. He's like, this is fantastic. Started using it. Come to find out, it had been stolen from some very important people in the city, and they found themselves hunted because of the other shoe dropping of that five.
I hope you noticed the glee in his voice in retelling that tale.
I might have a reputation for consequences in my games, yes. Coming back to biting.
Yes, but in his defense, he's quite upfront about it. There are consequences for your decisions.
That is true. And Mark has been on the receiving end of consequences that have happened to other players. He has never actually been on the receiving end of consequences of actions he has taken. Well, that's kind of it for relationship dice. Any final thoughts? How to use them? When to use them? Why to use them?
One of the mechanics that I thought was interesting in reading through the SRD on from the GM's perspective using relationship dice is the ability to, even in the middle of a session, if something kind of major happens, you can have them roll a relationship die at that moment. To try to either spur things on a little bit forward or kind of redefine, hey, this was something that really big that just happened. You just dethroned this king, and that's going to have an impact on the rest of the gameplay and the rest of your sessions. So I did like that. It was kind of gave the GMs a nice tool to use. You know, like you were saying, if things are just starting to slow down, all of a sudden you're like, you know what, let's roll a relationship die and see what's going on here.
Yeah. Well, that brings up one other thought for me. I tend to be much more of an improv GM, fly by the seat of my pants, just kind of a skin and bones outline to what's going to happen. The relationship die provide that framework for my style of gameplay. I can show up with just a couple of scenes in mind, and then the relationship dice kind of help me, okay, here's how these people are involved, here's the flavor of the encounters now. It's a very great tool if you're an improv GM.
Well, and on the flip side, too, you can adapt it to where if you need a little bit more planning, a little bit more time to kind of think through what you're doing, is you can have your players roll those die at the end of the session in anticipation of the next session. And so that would give you that week or month, you know, however long, you know, you wait between sessions to kind of plan out, okay, this is how I want to introduce this icon into this next session.
Okay.
Good idea. I will steal it.
Claw, claw, bite.
So as you may notice from our podcast logo. The white dragon is close to our hearts. It's kind of our mascot. We don't have a name for it yet. That may be our first contest that we do mailing.
Name that icon.
That's right. Name that icon.
And Whitey will not win the vote.
Whitey will not win the vote. Wow. Well, that didn't take too long. All right. So, Mark, you've played Dungeons & Dragons for the longest out of all of us. Have the white dragons always been kind of the weakest of all dragons?
Compared to other dragons, yes. They've always been the weakest. Never really considered the chump. I mean, to me, a dragon is a dragon. And if you're a player character, it should make you quake in your boots when you see a dragon. And I think it can, depending how it's played, like a lot of monsters. There again, a lot of my players quake in their boots when they see kobolds.
That's true.
That's another episode. Yeah, I quite distinctly remember in AD&D, way back when, in the G series against the Giants, and going against the Frost Giant Jarl, the White Dragon literally ate our lunch.
Oh, nice.
It was pretty tough, yeah. Pretty tough. Now, this might have been the GM because he was kind of a killer GM. But, yeah, they can be tough. They can be tough.
Well, Nick, tell us about the whites. Let us know. So just to give you an introduction, the white dragons are considered kind of the bottom of the draconic tier, if you will. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason we're doing this on the Icon Show, this monster on the Icon Show. So, Nick, give us a little introduction.
Well, a little bit of background on the white dragons in the world of 13th Age. There, as in all, each of the draconic races, there was the dragon for each one of the different races of dragons, if you will. And the white was killed by the Wizard King before he became the Lich King. And ever since then, the white dragons have just been this cowardly, fallen, subservient to the Lich King. Socially, they're more on the evil side, partly because they don't have any king or ruler or anything like that to kind of steer them or anything like that. They definitely still hold a grudge against the Lich King for killing the White, but they don't dare do anything about it because he has the power to transform them into undead servants. So it's kind of, they're kind of in a catch-22. They want to regain their power and their status, but they're pretty much afraid to.
So they've got ties to the Lich King icon, the Three icon, and really kind of the Great Golden Worm as well, just dragons of a feather kind of thing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. I think you're saying dragons have feathers?
Possibly. This could be an Eastern game set in a mythical dragon empire. Wait, it is set in a mythical dragon empire. They could have feathers.
The rulebook states that, you know, or implies that there are other evil dragon races, but it also states that whites are the most likely to work as mercenaries for anyone sketchy or desperate enough to hire them and who can afford them, because we all know dragons love their gold.
That's right.
They are ice-elemented or ice-aligned, so I guess if you had any hoary deed that you needed done, that they would be a good one to use.
Well, before we get into the actual stats of the monster, one thing to remember is that all dragons have special abilities, and you're going to want to turn to page 217 in your rulebook to kind of follow along here. Standard abilities that all dragons have, and this is very unique, very few monsters have things like this. They are an escalator. An escalator means, just like your player characters, they add the escalation die to all of their attacks, which means the longer the fight goes, the more powerful the dragon gets as well. All dragons fly, and all dragons have breath attacks, and they specifically call out that their breath attacks are indiscriminate. Unlike most close attacks that target a number of enemies, most dragon breath attacks don't care about where the targets are in the group. They just whip their heads around and spray the entire area. Rob and Jonathan, the guys who designed the game, did put a little call out here that dragons can be considered the exception to the rule that PCs should expect to win the battle of equal level. So you might have to remind your players to flee, possibly not from whites. Depends on how you use them, but...
And depending on the size of the dragon.
That's right. Also, roll for your random dragon abilities at the beginning of the game, or before the session starts. You roll a d12, and if you roll below or equal to the level of the dragon, they get a random ability that makes them even tougher. If you are particularly evil, you can add +2 to this roll to ensure your dragon has a special ability, or you can just ignore the roll and give your dragon a special ability.
You sound like you're speaking from experience.
I like dragon fights to be dragon fights, not...
Yes, and I like the random abilities. That's one of the things I like about some other games, that you can roll random abilities. I definitely like fooling the characters. Any of the people who played first or second edition, or in this edition, you know, reds or fire, whites or ice. And it's nothing like finding the albino red, and the party, you know, stocks up on all of those
cold resistances, potions, yeah.
And he breathes fire on them, and you're like, uh-oh, wrong dragon.
I was actually going to bring that up because it's one of my favorite stories, the albino red dragon. All right, well, let's go through the dragons real quick. White dragons cover a, like all dragons, three sizes, but they are at the lower end of the levels. So your medium white dragon is a second level creature. Large white dragon is considered a fourth level creature, and the huge is only a fifth. So your players can encounter these dragons quite early. Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about their statistics, as in my game world, dragons don't exist, so I don't really look at these creatures very much.
Yes. Well, like all dragons, they have that claw bite.
That's right.
Gotta love that multi-attack. Set damage, the second level troop medium white dragon, plus 6 on his attacks, does 4 damage. On a natural 16, he's going to get that ice breath attack as a free action. It's plus 6 against physical defense, 1d3 nearby enemies, 4 cold damage. On a natural odd hit or miss, the dragon takes 1d4 damage.
So these dragons are going to damage themselves the longer the fight goes on.
Again, they're a little bit
bigger. Which kind of adds to the heroic feel for the player side.
Yeah. Well, and you've got the fact that they're all resistant to ice damage, as you would expect. So, do you fight against any dragons, Nick, at this point?
No, I don't think so.
You're playing mostly in my world where...
Right, there is that.
The dragons don't show up. Mark, how would you use white dragons in games, or how have you used white dragons in games?
Well, they always make good bosses, and mm-hmm. you always have some mooks working for them.
Oh, yeah?
And that's another episode. We'll talk about mooks and minions. But they can also, because in this case they are weaker, they can be used, like Nick said, as mercenaries. Kind of reminds me of the old Dragonlance series, where nothing like having that sorcerer or knight riding a white dragon.
Oh, yeah.
Adds to the difficulty.
So you would use the white dragons in conjunction with just about any other creature.
You could. I mean, if they're going to work as a mercenary, hey, I'm a high-level fighter, and... I need you. I'm going to attack.
Fantastic. I didn't actually consider that.
Yeah, and along that vent, as a player asking GMs, if you had your players encounter a white dragon, and because of their history and their potential motivations, would you allow for them to try to negotiate with that dragon instead of just fight them?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, definitely. In fact, it might even be the dragon's viewpoint of, if these guys are brave enough to come in here and they've defeated my traps, or if I have minions of my own and they've defeated them, you know what? Let me negotiate with them, because I can always steal more treasure later, because that's usually what they're here for.
Right. I would also use a white dragon as a possible 5 or 6 on an icon relationship, mm-hmm. because in my mind, that's a perfect intrusion. Oh, you find a white dragon. Maybe you have a die that comes up against the Lich King, and the white dragon's like, oh, you're going against the Lich King? I'll sign on for this for reduced pay or something like that.
You know, it definitely helps those players who may not, I mean, combat's always fun, but for those people who do like more of the stories, that might be a nice way of engaging them.
Well, that's one thing that it says under the common dragon abilities. Remember, there is no such thing as a common dragon. All dragons have distinct personalities. They are not faceless dragon number one. They should never be faceless dragon number one. Give them personality. Give them something for the players to interact with, and give them some hooks for icon relationship dice to dangle from.
Yeah, I always try to remember when you put them out there, they are, even if it's, you know, whites are the weakest of the dragons, it's still a dragon. It's going to be the top of the predator heap.
Mm-hmm.
It should be the only dragon in that area. There shouldn't be multiples unless there's a good reason. For them to come together for a reason, but there shouldn't normally be more than one dragon that you're going to encounter.
Unless they're blue, red, and black.
No,
well, that's, and again, that they go together, but do they actually sit in the same cave?
Yeah. It's true. Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.